In the book of Shmuel, the beginning of Shmuel Beis, chapter 6, the Navi records that King David brought the Aron up towards Jerusalem. He wanted to bring it to Zion to establish it near his kingdom. And the first time that the procession went, there were things that were improper about the procession, and one of the people in the procession relieved himself directly in front of the Aron and was struck dead on the spot. And when he was struck dead, the people were in awe, and the procession stopped, and King David was fearful of continuing the procession. And a short while later, directly following that occurrence, they moved the Aron to a certain person's house, a Levi, who was supposed to serve the Aron, and that Levi's home was blessed. His wife had 6 children at a shot. Oh, his daughter-in-law had 6 children at a shot, and all the children were healthy, and everyone saw this miracle. They recognized that God was sending word that the Aron is a blessing. It's not something that brings on death. There was something improper done. And so David heard of this blessing, and he understood the message, and they started bringing the Aron towards Jerusalem in a new procession. And in that procession there was great rejoicing. Every few footsteps they would take, they would bring 6 sacrifices, and they had instruments playing, all kinds of instruments that were there in the kingdom. They had the greatest band ever, and King David was dancing. And he wasn't only dancing in front of the Aron, he was dancing with all of his might. And he was dancing, and he put all his strength into the dancing. He was dancing in honor of God. And he's dancing, and all the women are peeking through the peoples, through their windows, peeking out to see the great King David, their new king, who everyone had recognized his bravery, everyone had recognized his greatness. He's dancing, and everyone's dancing, and all the women are looking on. And as they enter the gates, they are entering Jerusalem. King David has a few wives, but one of them comes from noble descent. Her father was King Saul. Her name is Michal bat Shaul. Michal, the daughter of King Saul, and she was King David's first wife. And King David fought to attain her. And when King David was on the verge of regaining his kingdom, King David said, "I will not take the kingdom unless you first give me back my wife that my father-in-law stole from me." And when King David regained her, obviously he held her in high regard. And now she is looking on from within her room at King David. And she sees him dancing. Now, King Saul's family had tremendous qualities. One of their awesome qualities was modesty. When King Saul entered the cave as he was chasing David, and he thought no one else was in the cave, and David and all his men were hiding deep in the cave, and he wanted to relieve himself, and David crawled up behind him, David saw the modesty of King Saul. Here King Saul thinks he's alone in the cave, and even as he thinks he's alone and he's sitting down to relieve himself, he doesn't reveal himself. He's fully covered. He covers himself in a fashion that shows a modest person. He's wearing a cloak, some kind of robe, and he ensures that even as he's relieving himself, he does not reveal himself. And when King David sees this, he's in awe. He says, "Wow, what modesty." Yeah? Well, it says that he went lehasech et raglav. And our sages say, what does it mean, lehasech et raglav? So the word lehasech could stem from the word yain nesech, or something that's libated. It could mean to relieve himself, to so to speak, pour out his innards. It could also mean from the term sukkah, la'asech et raglav, could mean to cover his feet. And that's where our sages derive from that King Saul, when he sat down to relieve himself, covered his feet. So you could understand that in the simple understanding of the verse. King Saul was exceptionally modest. When it came time to anoint him as king, he was hiding. He didn't feel fit. He's going to be on top of everyone. And when his daughter, who had grown up on these traits, sees her husband dancing wildly in front of the Aron with all his might, and his gown is flapping up and down, and all the maids and everyone sees him like that, in her heart, she looks down upon him. And after everyone is so excited and they're rejoicing and they're singing and they're playing all the instruments, it's the fanciest party around, and King David gives everyone gifts, he gives everyone a fancy meal, and he's finished blessing the people, he starts heading towards his house. And Michal Batshol can't wait for him to come in. She walks out of the house. And outside in front of everyone, she starts telling him, Ma nichbad hayom, Melech Yisrael, how honorable is the day, the King of Israel, you revealed yourself like one of the empty people in front of your servants. Who's she saying this in front of everyone? He's standing there in front of everyone, the King of Israel, and his wife can't wait for him to enter the house. She walks out and she gives it to him. What's King David to do? So the Navi alludes to this story. The Navi tells us what Michal Batshol said. And the Navi tells us she walked out to him and said this. And then the Navi says, as though introducing a new story, that David answered her. But the Navi stresses, Vayomer David el Michal, a new story. Not David answered Michal, David told Michal. He told her something, but not at that moment. She just disgraced him in front of everyone. He just had the high, he's been accepted as the king, he's at the top. Everyone's accepted him, everyone's coming and dancing with him, they're rejoicing with God, and his wife knocks him off his saddle. And he doesn't answer. He waits till they're alone. He waits till she's calmed down. And then he tells her, Hun kaloti od mizot, vaiti shafal beinai, vima mahot asher amarti mam ikaveda. Tells her, think I'm disgraced? Think what I did is a disgrace? What did I do? I danced in front of the Aaron. I was rejoicing before God. Who was I dancing in front of? I was dancing in front of the God who chose me over your father. What's he telling her? He's giving it back to her? No. He waited. He didn't answer her in front of everyone. He's not interested in giving it back to her. He's pointing something out to her. He's telling her, Michal, you're falling for the same thing your father fell. The trait of modesty is a good trait. It's an amazing trait that your father had and that you acquired from him, and it's in your blood. But you should know it was your father's downfall, because your father's modesty also made it that when the people were pressuring him that we can't kill the king of Amalek, we can't kill the cattle, he gave way. When the people were pressuring him and they said, the Philistines are attacking, we have to go. And people started leaving the ranks. They said, oh, we're not attacking, so we got to run. He gave in to pressure. He was modest, but that modesty allowed him to give way to what other people wanted. And that modesty allowed him to fall, and that modesty is why God chose me over him. Because there's a time to be modest. And you know what? The fact that I dance like this in front of the people, they'll only respect me the more for it, because I wasn't dancing for myself. I was dancing for God. We know that the great sages, when it came to a wedding, they would dance with all their might. I once called my wife from a wedding. I was so excited. I came to a wedding. It was a guy who was an orphan. And the guy was, and one of the chief justices of the rabbinate knew the family. So one of the dayanim, a dayan, a person who's a judge, on the high court of Jerusalem, was there at the wedding, and the dancing began. And you see this man with his long black coat and his beard, which was already turning white, and his hat, and they're dancing in a circle, and he grabs the circle and starts running. And you see he's getting the circle moving, and he tells the guys, I don't understand you, this is a mitzvah, this is an orphan, where's your strength? And he's making the whole circle run quicker. So I called my wife, I said, look at this, where would you see a high justice who allows himself to enter the circle and dance with everyone else? Not only he's dancing, he's running. He's getting everyone running. Why? Because he's not interested in his own honor. So he wears the long coat. It's not for his honor. His job is to teach the people. He's there for the people. And now his job is to dance in front of this poor orphan who doesn't have a father to dance with him. So he's dancing. And he's putting all his strength into it. That's King David. So King David will put all his strength into dancing in front of the orphan. And when his wife looks on and mocks him, King David doesn't answer her on the spot. And that's the point we're going to learn about today. He was hit pretty badly across the face. in front of everyone, after he just finished dancing, his wife comes out and tells him, "You dance like a beggar, you dance like one of the people, what are you? This is how you behave?" In front of everyone, she's yelling at him, doesn't answer. And when he does answer, it's after things have calmed down, and he explains to her. And he's not looking to hurt her, he's looking to explain it to her. Michal was punished for what she said. She was punished that she never again had a child till the day she died. She had one more child in her lifetime, and that child was on the day she died. She died giving birth to that child. She was punished because she disgraced David, and she was punished because in essence she disgraced the honoring of Hashem, because what David was doing was honoring Hashem. But David doesn't answer her in front of everyone. And that's something to remember. What Rav Kitov told us when we saw last week was that how does one save oneself from machlokas in the home? He first controls himself. That's King David. By the same token that his dancing was because he was before Hashem, so too his answer to Michal is a reflection of the fact that he recognizes he's before Hashem. Yeah. Let's leave that for next week, sir. It's a good question, but the answer will take too long. Next week, Bezat Hashem, we'll learn the story more in depth. Remind me that we should deal with this question as well. I think you'll see the answer without us dealing with it direct, but remind me, Bezat Hashem, we'll deal with that question next week. Rav Kitov said, is it possible for a person never to anger? It's not possible. No one could expect never to anger. There wasn't such a person who didn't anger. Moshe Rabbeinu got angry. Everyone gets angry. But the key is that when a person gets angry, he should ease his anger. Go to sleep. Let it out outside the house. But in the house, not to show the anger. Person's angry, so be quiet. It's known that Chafetz Chaim, when he would get angry, he'd walk into the corner and talk to himself. And he'd say, Yisrael Meir, what are you doing? What are you angry about? It's known. He'd start talking, he'd have a conversation with himself till he calmed down. I believe that when one spouse asks the other spouse, why are you angry? The answer is because I didn't work on my mitzvos enough. Not that it's impossible that someone will do something that will anger you, but the real reason why we get angry is because we did not work on ourselves enough. If we had, then we would be like David HaMelech. I wouldn't respond out of anger. I'd say, let me explain to you why I disagree with you. The fact that we get angry, the root of anger is really with gava, with pride. The root of anger is that the person did not work on himself enough.
Hello?
Yeah?
There's several things that I'm trying to work on myself. How I relate to other people, how I deal with people when they just affect me. I can modify the way that I speak to people and create results that are better than I used to, but the reaction, the initial reaction, the anger is the absolute hardest.
It's
the hardest to control. Controlling what comes out of what your hands do, for that's one step. Controlling what comes out of your mouth, like, a little bit harder. And the hardest part is controlling yourself before they even have a chance to develop. And I heard some of the Sadiq is one that had complete control of himself and is not even going to react. He thought it's going to be no spark. And it's amazing how hard it is, because oftentimes before I know it, boom, amazing.
If you don't mind, could we shelve that till Thursday night? Just want to cover what we did last week. We advanced a drop in Rav Eliyahu Kitov. I want to go back to the questions we asked last week. And that's going to require the 25 minutes that are remaining to try to deal with. If you don't mind, remind me that last week we read a letter from me to you guys. And we had a bunch of questions, which you guys answered for yourselves. And those of you wanted handed it in. I want to go back to what we discussed last week. We discussed the question, what is love? And we discussed that often people have a skewed view of love, and Western society trains us to have a skewed view of love. And most often when people think of love, they don't realize it, but they're thinking of self-love. Their love rotates around, what is that person to me? What am I going to get out of that person? And that's why people can say, I love a person, when they don't know them just because they see their looks. That's why people can say they love fish when they have no feelings for the fish whatsoever. They love themselves, they like to eat the fish. Very often in life, we think we love someone when really we love ourselves, which is natural, but we should recognize it. And that is why true love is something that develops after marriage. Because after marriage, when we start giving, and we start wanting to give more and more, and the emotions grow deeper, that love really grows. Now, when we love someone, so we want what's good for them. And that breaks down to many levels. Men usually focus on one level, the basic needs. I provide, I bring a parnasa home, I buy her a gift every so often, I bring flowers home. That's nice. But there are other levels that we have to remember. That level is for sure included. To bake, to cook, to provide. But there's the spiritual. When it comes to the spiritual, people sometimes get confused. So I love you, so I'm waking up for minyan, honey. Get out, go daven. I love you. I'm telling you to have Shabbos ready an hour early. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about one breathing down the other one's neck. What we are talking about is that maybe he should offer to babysit an evening so that she can go to a class she wants to listen to. Maybe he should pray early on Shabbos morning so he could be home and watch the kids so that she could pray normally Shabbos day. So that she could maybe go to a minyan where her friends are and join the prayer and enjoy the prayer. That's something that you have to figure out. But we're not talking about looking over one's shoulder. That's a mistake. That's not our job in marriage. We're not there to look at what one another is doing and comment on one another's spiritual level. The contrary, we're there to grow together. And where we could, if we love the other person, we're going to provide them the ability to grow. And that goes both ways. Sometimes guys come to me and they have a very good relationship with a girl, but on religious issues they don't see eye to eye where they're headed. And to an extent, this affects to where they want to grow to. And for some reason, this happens all the time here at the Machon. And I feel like it's a bit of a confusion that people have with regard to relationship within Judaism. If this is part of what's integral to you, your spiritual growth, your learning, wherever you want to head, so this is part of where your relationship has to extend to. On the one hand, we're not looking to breathe down one another's back. But on the other hand, if this is important to me, then we have to match on this. And matching doesn't always mean that we see exactly eye to eye, but we should be in the same direction. I don't understand how people could date a girl that doesn't want to cover her hair and is willing to let him go to class once a week when he wants to learn full time and he's willing to compromise on working half time and learning half time. But what can I say? That this is the feedback I'm getting. Guys are doing this. And they're asking me whether they should marry the girl. And I don't understand. So like in my letter, I'm posing the question to you. How is this going to work? And that's a question which I always ask. A guy tells me, I'm dating a girl and she's not sure she wants to keep Shabbos. Do you want to keep Shabbos? Yes. How is this going to work? She's thinking about it. I don't know. I try to be liberal. I try to be accepting. But I don't understand how that works in dating and in marriage. So because I'm baffled by what's going on, I'm throwing the questions back at you. I'm not giving answers, I just don't understand. These things, theoretically, are supposed to be fundamental. I don't care if a girl leaves a tefach uncovered. There are halachic opinions that say she could leave a tefach by a tefach uncovered. No problem. A girl wears pants, You have to ask yourself where exactly you want to be headed, who's your rabbi is going to be. But a girl says she doesn't want to cover her hair and he doesn't want her to cover her hair. I don't understand. So my feeling is, and this is the next point we're going to get to, that to an extent people aren't thinking through what they should verify before marriage. But before we get to that, I want to add one more point that people sometimes miss when it comes to marriage, when it comes to giving love. And that is time. I'm going to post a short article on the Dorter of Listen's office to watch him at the end of class about time. And I recommend you read it. It's short. It'll take you less than 5 minutes to read. Time is one of the most precious things we could give a person. Time is affection. When a child comes home and he wants to show his father his drawing, the father can say, in a few minutes, son, I'm in the middle of the New York Times, or the Super Bowl is running. Give me just a second. Let me see this touchdown. Or he could stop and say, this is important to me. What we do shows our children what's important to us. How often is it that women have conversations with their husband and they're busy reading the newspaper? How often is it that women ask their husbands 100 questions and they're busy eating their breakfast or their lunch or their supper? Yeah, sure. It goes both ways. Don't get me wrong. Wives do this to husbands as well. But this class is for guys. So I'm talking about husbands. To our female listeners, don't think this is a male phenomenon. Women do this also. Yes, honey, sure, yeah. I once saw a guy. His wife was talking to him on the cell phone. And she's talking away. And someone else comes to talk to him. So he puts down the cell phone and he talks to the other guy. Every few seconds he picks it up and says, yeah, yeah. Puts it down and continues talking to the guy. Sounds funny. But it's a problem. So a word to our female listeners. A wise woman measures her words. A word to our male listeners. The Gemara says that there were 10 kabim, 10 measurements of speech that were brought down to the world. 9 were given to women and 1 to men. So they're supposed to talk 9 times as much as men. So that's how God created them. That doesn't mean all the talking is going to be with us, but part of what loving a person means is that we give, and give isn't something that we're inclined to give. If you're inclined to give it, you're not really giving. Giving, by definition, is giving something that you might not be so inclined to give. And one of the things that people find hardest to give is time. To stop and treat what the other person is saying seriously. Meaning if you're reading something, someone comes to you, to pick up your head and talk to them. If you're busy doing something, watching something, and someone talks, to stop and talk to them. One of the things that Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz once taught me, he's an educator in New York, he said, the biggest message I give children when they come to talk to me, and he said, in my opinion, it's one of the reasons they keep coming back, is when they enter my office, I unplug the phone. They know that now I am fully with them, I'm not answering anything else. How often do we give someone that message? How often do we talk to someone and answer the cell phone in between? People sometimes are talking to me at home and they hear the phone ringing and they say, aren't you going to answer it? So I say, well, if I were in the middle of talking to you and someone else would walk over and try to interrupt, I say, excuse me, I'm talking to this person. So just because it's the phone means that he's entitled to enter a conversation. So he doesn't know I'm in the middle of a conversation. I never signed a contract to stop my conversations with people in order to answer the phone.
It might be important,
right? But this person's important, I know. The phone might be important. What I'm showing a person when I answer the phone is that that might be important is more important than that person. Unfortunately, it's very common that spouses will have a conversation and the phone rings and they go to answer the phone. One of the things I do when I sit down and talk to my wife, I unplug the phone or take it off the hook. She's an important person too. Not two. She's the important person. So why is something else might be important more important than my conversation with her? Might be. When I have relatives that it might be an emergency for, so I leave the cell phone on. On the cell phone I can see who's calling. If it's a relative, so sometimes I'll have to apologize and answer because it might be. I have relatives here in Israel who have no one else but me, so I have to answer. That's true. So I do have an out. One of the things that's important to show with that time is appreciation. I want to share with you a story. guy wakes up early in the morning to go to work. 4:30 in the morning. He creeps out of bed, takes a shower, he gets dressed, he looks around the house. The children are sleeping calmly. The house is all neat, clean, everything's in its place. Beautiful. He goes out to work. Spends the day at work, and it's going to be a late night. Meanwhile, the kids get up 5 minutes after he leaves the house. 10 to 6, his wife is being pulled out of bed. One kid has to go to the bathroom. Mommy, open my pajamas. She can barely open her eyes, and she unzips his pajamas, and he goes to the bathroom. And he misses. The floor is dirty. Before she can deal with the floor, the next kid is up and wailing. She goes to get that kid, and the first kid says, Mommy, I'm dirty. I need to change the pajamas. So she's dealing with one kid, holding him in her arms, and then she goes to change the other kid's pajamas. All the while, the bathroom's dirty. She's dealing with the second kid, changing his pajamas, and the third kid awakens. Now, that kid needs to nurse. So she starts nursing that baby, and the first kid says, Mommy, I want a drink. I'm thirsty. So as she's nursing, she waddles over to the kitchen and pours that kid a drink of milk. The kid's drinking, and he drops the glass cup, and now there's milk with glass all over the floor. Now it's already 7 o'clock in the morning, and she has 3 kids and a balagan in the house. The kids start playing. She finishes nursing that baby, puts it to sleep, and goes thinking to deal with the balagan. But the kids have been busy meanwhile, and there's more balagan in the house. The house is a bit of a wreck. We're holding 7:30 in the morning, and she has to get the kids out by 8 and get to work. The house is a total wreck. She hasn't yet gotten to the bathroom. There's still glass and milk on the floor in the kitchen, and she's chasing after the kids trying to get them dressed and out to school and hurt at the job. She can barely get herself dressed while she has to get the kids dressed, while she has to make the bus, while she has to put her stuff together, while she has to put the kids' lunches together, while she has to get the kids out of the house. And they haven't brushed their teeth. So she runs to brush their teeth, and they start smearing toothpaste. It's a new game. She says, the kids can't do that. She can't yell. She has to be nice. They're kids. Okay. So she tries to tell them, and she gently takes away the toothpaste, puts it up on the shelf. She hasn't dealt with the toothpaste all over the shower room. Now she's gotten the kids out of the house, and she has about 3 minutes to make it to her own ride, and the house is a mess. Okay, I'll deal with it when I get home. She goes to work. She gets to work, and she has a haggling day, which we won't go into all the details. And finally, she gets back home, 4:30, and the kids come home. One kid's had a terrible day in school. Another kid getting black and blue eyes. She has to take him to the doctor. Now she has to deal with what she can do with the other two kids while she's going to the doctor. So she takes them along with her. What? Why do you think I'm inventing this story? I told you all my stories are true. Some have happened, some will happen. They're all true. So she takes the kid to the doctor, only to discover the other kid is scratching his head. He has lice. Now she has to deal with the lice. She comes back home, and the house is still a wreck. And the kids have been busy making it a bigger wreck. They discovered that if you mix the milk with the toothpaste, it makes quite a swirl in the kitchen. Now the kitchen's a wreck, the shower room's a wreck, the bathroom's a wreck, and she hasn't dealt with it, and it's pretty stinky from the morning. She tells herself, thank God my husband has a late night today. She hasn't caught her breath. She hasn't had breakfast. She hasn't had lunch. She's wondering, does the doctor mind talking to me when my breath smells this way? Fine. She pops a mint into her mouth. She thinks to herself, is this the first thing I ate today at 5 o'clock in the evening? She says, yeah. Pity I didn't accept the fast on myself. At least it would have been worth something. Fine. She's running out with the kids. She finally gets home. The kid with the lice in his head needs a bath, but the shower's a wreck. So she takes his head to the sink in the kitchen, and she starts washing his head and combing out his hair while the other kids are busy making more of a mess. Now the living room's a mess, the dining room's a mess, the kitchen's a mess. Broken things here, broken things there. Shower room's a mess. And slowly she starts putting the kids to bed. She puts one kid to bed. She puts the next kid to bed, and suddenly she sees he's scratching his head too. You have lice too? Wait, deal with it. So the first kid's in bed. The baby's asleep. Now she's dealing with that third kid getting the lice out of his head. It's 8 o'clock at night, and now she can start cleaning up the house. She hasn't eaten anything. She hasn't drank anything. She sits down for a second and says to herself, maybe I should eat something. And she says, no, my husband will be home in a half hour. I want him to come to a nice home. So she starts working. And she cleans and she scrubs and she scrubs and she cleans and she sets the house all neat. And a half hour later, she's just finishing and sweat is dripping down her brow. And she's wondering, when's the next time I'm going to get a shower? And she's feeling all stinky and icky. And her husband walks through the door. And he looks at the house. And it's just the way he left it in the morning. The kids are neatly in bed. The house is all neat. Everything's clean. Wow. He looks at her and he says, honey, this is how I left it this morning. Did you do anything today? Why are you sweating? I just wanted to share this story with you. You guys have to think what the measure is. Getting back to what about time. So one of the things that we have to do with the time that we give our spouse is to show appreciation. That's how we got into the story. What is it important to verify before marriage? So we had a whole class in dating on this, but being that we're discussing what love is all about, so what will the marriage be built on? That was one of the questions that we asked last week. Marriage is predicated on mutual respect. Respect doesn't mean that when I walk into the room she has to stand up, or when she walks into the room I have to stand up. We're talking about respecting who the person is. So the first thing is we have to respect the other person. And sometimes in dating we overlook this. Sometimes it's convenient to date someone who's less intelligent than us. The Gemara says that men have a tendency, and a healthy tendency, to want someone who's a little bit less than them. That's fine, if it's a little bit. It's not fine if it's a lot and the man will not respect her. It is important that there's mutual respect. It is important that the husband respect his wife, and it is important that the wife respect her husband. And that respect, to an extent, has to do with the essence of who we are. Sometimes there are things that are fundamental to us and they don't speak to the other person. I once dated a girl that I was very excited about, and I took her to a museum. There's a free museum here in the neighborhood, and they had a thing about Einstein. So we start walking in, and I start explaining to her about the theory of relativity as we're going through the different things. Yeah. And she's yawning. We jump to E equals MC squared, and I could see she's not even listening. I said, okay, let's go out. There are nice flowers outside. It isn't critical for me that the person I marry, it wasn't critical for me that the person I marry understand about Einstein. That's not a critical part of me. I don't think they should respect it. I don't think they should understand it. It's interesting for me. So it's an interest that we don't share. I don't have to share every interest. But the things that are of essence, an essence of who I am, that has to be respected. If a guy is dating a girl who doesn't respect the fact that he is a ger, that's a problem. The person, you talk about it. If you're dating a girl and she's a ger and you don't respect her for that, that's a problem. That's an essence of who she is. Respect has to deal with the essence of who we are. Not just, oh, respect me, it's a nice person. If a person has overcome, how do you know this?
Someone
part of what you
say,
date.
Someone can say yes. I mean.
That's why you date for a while. You listen, you see. You never know, but you try to verify. There are challenges that we've overcome. There are things that are important to us. Respect, sometimes we have to learn what to respect about the other person, what they value about themselves. But we have to apply it to where the other person feels it. Sometimes we learn it, but the things that are part of our essence, that has to be there. To a certain respect, we have to have mutual interest, and to a certain respect, we have to have mutual priorities. Our priorities have to be similar. Can't be that a guy is dating a girl who tells him, I will want you to take me to the movies 3 nights a week, and he's saying, I will want to spend my nights learning, and they don't see that there's a problem. There's when we're dating, the question isn't, can I respect what she wants? The question is, do we match? Appreciation and goals. Where do you want to get to in life? It's interesting what people say, and it's interesting that I speak to girls, I don't know if to say unfortunately or not, but I speak to girls almost every night. Girls call us to help us try to set them up with guys. It's interesting that the girls from the more religious crowd, when you ask them where they want to get to in life, they have an answer. And it's an answer they've thought out. When we speak to a girl who is not so religious, so you ask her, what are your goals in life? And the answer I've gotten is, you're trying to stumble me? Ask me difficult questions, huh? Trying to trick me? I'm floating. Said, I didn't know this was a tricky question. Not looking to some of you. I just want to know what kind of guy is for you. I'm quoting you something that went on last week. Last week, I get this month. So, wow. No. Well, part of what being religious teaches us is, what are our goals in life? Where are we headed? What are we looking to do? I wanted to deal with the question, why we don't touch before marriage. And I'm not sure that this is going to take more than a few minutes. So those of you who want to go, officially the class is over. Whoever wants can go. Those of you who want to stay, we'll try to just deal with it in short. The most basic and true answer as to why we don't touch before marriage is because the Torah says so. Period. Now we could understand why that works. But first we have to know, everything we're going to say beyond this point is just trying to understand what the Torah says. But the reason we don't touch before marriage is because that's what it says in the Torah. You cannot touch a girl in an affectionate way, and any normal male, when he touches a girl, there's going to be some affection there. I'm not talking about a guy who's on a bus and there's a 75-year-old woman who's trying to get off the bus and extends her hand to try and help her down. That's not what I'm talking about. And I'm not talking about that 5-4-year-old girl who's asking her to give her hand to cross the street. But in between, so then normally that's what's going to be. There's going to be affection there. So the Torah forbids us to touch other than our wife when we're permitted to do it. We're not allowed to. If we think about it, so then that doesn't help at all, touching before marriage. Quite the contrary. It only serves to confuse us. If what we're looking for is someone that we match with, someone we can respect, someone we can love, someone who shares our goals, someone who shares our interests, by touching, so that can affect the person. I could tell you, even if it weren't male and female, when I started teaching, so I read a lot of books about education. One of the things they teach you is that kids, sometimes if they're acting up, it's because they want attention. So one of the things you could do is walk by the kid and put a hand on his shoulder. And even though you're a boy, and you're a male, and the kids are male, that very often, that piece of attention, you don't have to talk to the kid, will calm the kid down. So I said, hey, I'll try that. So I walked into a class, at a class where they all needed a lot of attention. So I walked to one kid as he starts acting up, I put a hand on his shoulder as I'm teaching class, he's quiet. The next kid starts acting up, I put a hand on his shoulder, he's quiet. And I see it works one by one. And then there was the last kid who never acted up. So I said, you know, it's not fair. Poor kid, he sees I put my hand on everyone else's shoulder, I'm not going to put my hand on his. I said, yeah, but he doesn't need it. So I was contemplating with myself, and what do you know, that kid starts acting up first time in the class. He also wanted it. He knew it. And it was interesting. I tried it a second time, and it reached a point I was giving them a test, and I put a hand on one kid and another kid, and again I left one kid out, and I wasn't sure, like, why should I disturb him? He's in the middle of the test, he doesn't need me to come over. So as I'm walking by, he takes my hand and puts it on his shoulder. I was shocked. I'm not sure the kid even got what he was doing. If I wasn't doing it for educational purposes, if I was just like naturally putting a hand on someone's shoulder as I'm looking at his test, I wouldn't have noticed. But this is what happened. We all need that. But when we have that, that affects us. Even if it's just one male with another male. Certainly if it's a male and a female, then it takes on a whole new meaning. And it only serves to just clarify the situation. It doesn't add clarity. It takes away from the clarity. And if we think about what's important in marriage, so that's not what's important. Look, yeah. A girl has to be looking in a way that you find appealing. A guy has to be looking in a way that a girl finds appealing. That's important. I'm not going to belittle that. But the touch, that's not important. If you think about it honestly, you'll realize that that's something we want. Baruch Hashem, we're healthy males. But it's not necessary. Not only isn't it necessary, but it serves to hamper our efforts in trying to discern, is this person fit for us or not. Again, that's not the reason why we don't do it. We don't do it because the Torah forbids it. But to understand why it's going to work without it, well, it works better without it. Like I wrote someone who recently asked the question, it's interesting that since people have broken the walls of society, since people have started living together and touching and doing everything before marriage, we see that the divorce rate has gone up, it hasn't gone down. And this goes back to what we discussed in the beginning, what is love? And what is happening when you touch someone and there isn't the relationship that can really be love, there isn't marriage, there isn't that binding force between them. The person is only touching for himself. He is not really giving the other person, he is taking. And when we take, we're not gaining knowledge of the other person, we're taking from the other person. In marriage, then a person can touch and take, a person can touch and give. A person is supposed to give, and intrinsically he will also take. But beforehand, I find it hard to believe it's feasible, and I find it hard to believe anyone would even claim that's what they're doing. So, logically, I think it's understood, but that's not why we do it. We do it because that's not halacha. Any questions? If you want, there's a good book on it called The Magic Touch, which they have here in the library. And I think I have free copies. I don't remember if in Hebrew or in English. If anyone wants. Yeah? Okay. If anyone wants, you can get it from David, you can get it from the library. So, shukra.